Hello. We are sitting here today recording on site at the Future Security Forum in Washington, D.C. I say we for once because I'm not alone. I've got Steve Jones with me.
Yes, you do. Steve Jones is with you today. You're very lucky, aren't you?
I'm very lucky. Steve Jones is our Director of Partner Relations, and he's been on quite a few of the podcasts so far, and he's going to be on even more after today. Because this event, we're sponsoring it as the Global Soft Foundation, but it's primarily put on by New America, a think tank based here in D.C., as well as Arizona State University. And one cool thing that we've been able to do while we're here is talk to a lot of the speakers after they give their presentations.
Yes. What a wonderful opportunity to kind of, I didn't have to wait in line with my hand in the air to ask the questions I wanted to ask. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, when you hear my voice, you know, I'm pretty much asking what I thought was important. But I think the speakers had a great opportunity to kind of say the things that they didn't get to say, like on a 4-person panel. And I think they all had fun. I know they did.
Because they got to talk to us.
Of course, of course.
Today's episode is going to be our recording with the Honorable Sharon Burke. She's a senior advisor to a few of New America's programs. She primarily focuses on international security and resource security. And she was a lot of fun to talk to.
Yeah, she was. I mean, just based on energy security and the experience that she has. And I mean, she was our very first speaker that we had today and just kind of set the tone for the day.
And it was a solid tone.
Yes.
So we talked about the Arctic, how things are changing there, the resources that may or may not become available.
There's a lot I discovered about Arctic and Arctic policy, the intense competition, and what the change in phase zero means.
So without any further ado, here is our podcast with the Honorable Sharon Burke.
And then if we want to break it down...
Global Soft Foundation. My immediate reaction was, this is awesome.
Cyber Protection Association for Special Operations.
You have our support. Let's move.
Welcome to SoftSpot.
Well, thank you, Sharon Burke, for being here with the Global Soft Foundation podcast. And I just got to listen to a session with you in which the topic was the future of conflict in the Arctic. Which was really interesting. You had a National Geographic photojournalist, Louis, how do you say his last name?
Palou.
Oh. And he had just, in the fall, the issue will come out, he was just telling us, with all of his photos. And so what got you interested in the Arctic and your background in environmental security and the, you know, relationships to national security?
So my background is actually as more of a national security generalist. I mean, my degree originally was in Middle Eastern studies, and I joined the Pentagon as a management fellow, and my first job was in the Near East South Asia office, and I was the director for all of South Asia, because that was a long time ago, and they could have one person on that account back then.
Right.
But I was always very interested in energy and the role that energy plays in national security and the links there between what creates stability and instability and the importance of energy as a military input and also as sort of the input for the nation state as a necessary input. So I had always been interested in that and worked on it as a defense professional for a long time. Increasingly over the years, though, it became clear to me that you can't look at energy security and the links to national security without also understanding the consequences, which is climate change. When I came back to the Pentagon, I left for a little while, and when I came back in 2010 as the lead official for energy and for military energy security, that the Arctic became part of that portfolio and understanding. I mean, it was a lot of people's portfolio, as is the case with anything where there's multiple AORs involved. But certainly the energy implications and the role of climate change were driving concerns with the Arctic. So we started to get interested in what it meant for the United States and for the United States Armed Forces more specifically. So in the years that I was the energy official, we increasingly started to pay attention to what the Arctic meant for our future.
Mm-hmm. So one of in the session we were just in, you did a great scene setter, and maybe you can give some of the statistics you did in there with regard to ice loss and oil reserves, although Louis, I think, pushed back a little bit, and he said, well, people don't even know where the oil is and if it's accessible. So he talked about people are kind of inventing narratives about it. What's your view on that?
I think what Louis was saying is certainly an important point, because you think about the Arctic, like think about what comes up in your mind, what pictures, and one of them is sure to be one of these like early 19th century, maybe, pictures of a ship stuck in the ice, right?
Yes.
Or there's a famous picture of a polar explorer in his big bearskin jacket with his tiny wife next to him. You know, these are the images of these intrepid people trying to conquer the frozen north and being defeated by and large, right? Because for all of human recorded history, the Arctic has been frozen. Mm-hmm. And it's been very difficult to exist up there. As Louis said, even now, when he was embedded with forces up there, it was 60 below zero. And it was dark for, you know, 24 hours a day at times that he was there. So this is a really harsh environment. And what Louis was saying is it's become something of a blank slate where people are able to project on this scrim, you know, what they think the Arctic is going to be. And I think that's always been true. Again, when you look at those historical photos of these brave explorers who wanted to conquer it and got conquered instead, it's always had this lure, the North Pole,
yes,
wanting to get there and explore it and be the first, right? But it's so since we've started with satellite measurements, I believe in 1979, the Arctic has lost 40% of its ice. And now the projections are being updated that scientists believe it's going to be ice-free in the summer by 2030, which is really soon. Mm-hmm. Now, what does that mean? It means a lot of different things. So there's a lot of oil and gas up there. There's a lot of minerals up there, including things like nickel, lead, rare earth elements that are critical for the modern information technology economy and the modern military also. It's an estimated $1 trillion worth of minerals, an estimated billion barrels of oil, 30% of what's unexplored of the natural gas in the world. So there's a lot of resources, a lot of fisheries, a lot of fish. So there's all this resource wealth up there that's been completely inaccessible. Now, Louis's right in that it's not fully explored for obvious reasons. It's frozen, right? Mm-hmm. You can't really get up there with your seismic tools and really understand the extent. But still, there have been enough explorations to believe that this is a place of tremendous resources. It's becoming accessible.
Right.
More to the point, it's a transpolar trade route that's never existed in human history. You could not get through there in a ship, right? Mm-hmm. Well, now you can. For the first time, right? You can go the Northern Sea Route along the Russian coast already. The Northwest Passage you can get through, not easily. And again, by 2030, scientists are saying in the summer you'll be able to get through the Arctic Ocean. So in naval terms, this is an entirely new ocean to patrol, to access. However, when you say ice-free, that's relative, right? You still, even by 2030, with the current projections, you can't possibly go through there without ships that are specially hardened for that environment, without icebreakers. It's going to remain a really harsh, forbidding environment. And that's part of what our discussion was and what Louis's point is that this will remain a really difficult place to operate for everyone, for militaries, for all militaries, for the Russian military, for the Canadians who've been operating up there for a long time. It's a really harsh environment.
Right. How would you characterize the competition there now? You know, real quick, who are the major players? And how would you describe the current situation?
So I think in the national security community, there's a lot of expectation that this is the new great game, that there's a high north geopolitical element that hasn't been there again in our history, other than for missile defense and as a border region. But again, an incredibly difficult place to operate. But all of a sudden, with it thawing, this is becoming an area of keen interest. So you have the littoral states, the five states that actually have Arctic coastline, which is the United States, Canada, Denmark, Norway, and Russia. And Russia has huge Arctic coastline. This is part of their identity, right? The high north is is essential to Russian identity. But then you also have near littoral states such as Finland, who are subarctic and have a lot of game in the Arctic region. But then it gets more interesting. So the Chinese are not an Arctic state, but they have an icebreaker, a heavy icebreaker, a new one, right? And they're building another one. They've made, I think the Coast Guard said since 2013, something like 6 passages through the region. And they call them, they've said they want to build a new polar Silk Road, which is understandable because that transpolar north-south route cuts off weeks of transit, right? So it's a huge interest to them and part of their Belt and Road Initiative now. Mm. So all of a sudden, this is a realm of great power competition and of geopolitical interest, which just wasn't possible before.
Right. So would you say people or countries are positioning themselves? Like, is that kind of the stage we're at now?
I think that's well put, yes. Countries are positioning themselves. They're building the kinds of gear they need to operate up there. So the Russians have an estimated 40 icebreakers, including, I think, maybe 11 that are nuclear-powered, which is pretty unusual. Mm-hmm. A lot of people will make much of the fact that the Russians have a comparative advantage. And maybe they should, maybe they shouldn't. The Russians have a huge Arctic coastline, and they already have a lot of economic activity up there. They are rehabilitating old Soviet bases. They are starting to put presence up there, and they're making a lot of noise about putting presence up there. But it's not necessarily threatening. There's as much history of cooperation around Arctic issues as there is competition. It's just, again, as you're talking about a region that's never been opened before and that everybody wants access to, yeah, it's a new ballgame.
How prepared do you think that we as the U.S. are?
You know, that's a mixed picture, and there's been a lot of concern in national security circles that we're not as well prepared as we should be. So you say Russia has 40 icebreakers. The United States has 5, and only one of them works. So as a heavy icebreaker that can really operate up there. Right. So on the other hand, we have submarines that regularly transit that region. We have aircraft that regularly operate in that region. We can go through there if we want to, and we do all the time. So it depends on why you want to be there and what you want. And again, some people will say, well, we need to go up there to exploit oil. The conditions are really harsh. The economics of it just don't work out. No one's going to want to build oil rigs up there. Now, the Russians are along their coastline, but their coastline is warmer water than relative to the rest of the Arctic. So it's not necessarily a threatening thing, but it's not hard to see a future when it could be. So we have a comparative disadvantage in some ways, but again, we have a long history of operating up there too, and we can get up there when we want to.
And how does this lead into your project with New America and Phase Zero, talking about competition and, you know, rebuilding our security cooperation with our partners and things like that?
So we have a project that we called Phase Zero. I understand that Secretary Mattis, I guess he's reverted to General Mattis now, that General Mattis sort of outlawed that phasing concept. Mm-hmm. Because let's face it, war is not so linear these days. We're not going neatly from deterrence to force flow to combat. Mm-hmm. However, that concept of Phase Zero, that before you're in a conflict situation or the run-up to a conflict situation, you still have time and tools to shape the strategic environment, either to prevent conflict or to tilt it at the battlefield in your favor. And I think that's a concept that's been in military circles for a long time. What's different to me is now we have more tools to sort of diagnose that time period and more ways to build preventive tools and shaping tools, but we don't necessarily do it. And I think we're living in a time when our focus is on lethality for wars that we don't want to actually fight. We don't want to get in a shooting war with the Chinese. So what more can we do in this Phase Zero time frame to make sure that we don't end up in shooting wars, or that if we do, that we win? And this is, of course, a concept that special operators right away are like, Roger that. I know what you mean. So we're building a project to both as a diagnostic project, like what are the opportunities here? How can we use some of the new big data tools and machine learning to understand better how conflict happens and where the points of intercession are? So we're looking at a lot of different things. We're looking at how climate change is going to change China's strategic drivers, like who's important to them for their agriculture right now and how's that going to change over the coming decades? Who's going to become more important to them? We're looking at strategic minerals and critical minerals. And again, where is this competitive space? And how do we shape it? And how are they already shaping it? Because they're thinking about that competitive space very differently than we are. And they're shaping it in ways that I don't think we're really countering too well. So we're diagnosing and looking at all of that and trying to characterize the opportunities. And the Arctic is sort of the ultimate phase zero space in that there's a lot of geopolitical interest. It's changing very fast. It's where everything comes together. There's huge economic interests at stake. There's transportation interests at stake. There's strategic and military, and including a lot of border security issues for us. A very long northern border that we have a history of missile defense that we kind of have to dust off and improve now that all of a sudden this border might be accessible. So we're looking at that in terms of phase zero and how you shape it now. I think, yeah, so it all fits together for us, and we're just really interested in this shaping part of the strategic environment.
Time for a quick interruption to plug one of our sustaining corporate partners, Cisco. Most of you have probably heard of them because they are a worldwide leader in information technology that combines advanced solutions in networking, computing, security, communications, video, and mobility to provide a responsive and unified environment, allowing government to securely utilize information anywhere, anytime, for improved situational awareness, decision-making, and delivery of the mission. Thank you, Cisco, for being a sustaining partner for such a long time. And with that, we're going to get back to the podcast.
What I liked the program from what I read your website was that you were curating different tools in this open, you know, open source information space that can be very overwhelming. And so it struck me as a really great resource that we probably need to, and that's what we're talking about now, like spread the word about, because it seems like a great resource to kind of figure your way out of what can be a very overwhelming information overload.
There's a lot of decision support tools. It's funny, I hadn't really heard that term while I was working in the Pentagon, but scientists use it all the time. They think about it in terms of the data tools and the informational gathering tools and how you fashion them into something that can support active decisions in the military space. That's a decision support tool. So we looked at a range of sort of conflict and resource and different tools that have been built to try to understand what that space looks like and you know, did a survey partly because we wanted to get involved in building them and we wanted to know what was already out there. We wanted to survey the ground before we jumped in and make sure that we're providing something that's going to be useful for people at the end of the day. And one of the tools we're working on is with a water, peace, and security partnership where we're looking at it's right now it's oriented at Africa, and we're looking at, can you take the evidence from satellites, from on the ground, from hydrology, from, you know, infant mortality, corruption indices, all of these things, and sort of push them together to get a better picture of what are the root causes of conflict and the root causes of stability, and where can you put pressure on something, and can you build a tool like this that helps you analyze that better and helps you test what might lead to conflict, what might prevent conflict. And we're just about to go do some field testing for that in Africa to see with people on the ground, does it answer the right kinds of questions? Can it help them prioritize some of their own investments? Can it help them communicate to leadership elements, to headquarters elements back in the United States, why they see certain investments as priorities. So we did that survey of tools in part so that we would know where to invest in new tools.
Do you get to do a lot of field testing like that? Because you talk about all this data you collect, and I was wondering when you were talking to Louis today, if that's like something you get to do often, like talk to someone who's actually been there, or if that's not incorporated as much.
It's not common for a think tank to do that. Mm-hmm. But I think increasingly for think tanks, you have to ground truth what you're doing. And in the sort of tech community, they would call it user-centered design. That if you're going to write a report or produce a decision support tool, it's important to go talk to the people that you want to consume it and use it and find out what they want and what they need. And I want all the work that we do to be actionable. And, you know, I'm particularly oriented at the armed forces, at the U.S. Armed Forces. So I want it to be actionable for them. And having been on the other side of that exchange and, you know, people of goodwill coming to you with interesting ideas and studies, but that you couldn't use in practice, I want to make sure that what we're doing is usable. So we're looking for a variety of ways to do that and to make sure that we understand what's going to be useful. So increasingly, I would say that even think tanks, you know, who usually traditionally sit back and study the problem, that we're studying the problem in dialogue with the people that we want to affect or help.
Do you think that it's a challenge for if Department of Defense dollars is going more towards near-peer competition, but you are traveling to spaces where, you know, the United States security strategy is willing to take risk? Do you find it challenging to find new partners to execute, you know, so you have catastrophic success in your research? Now what?
Oh, catastrophic success.
Yeah, we like that term.
Is that good or bad, right?
Exactly. Okay. Yeah.
That is a very diplomatically put point. But I think part of our work as a think tank is not to just sort of follow what people want, but rather to see where the open space is and show them where they could go. So we've entered this phase where we're now, I think we were in near peer and great power competition for a while, but now we're explicitly so. And, you know, we could have a longer conversation about whether that was wise even. It certainly changes our maneuver space to be unambiguous about the time period that we're in. But it's also useful because we can be more honest with our own public about why we're doing what we're doing. What I would say is, you know, the National Defense Strategy called it the competitive space, right? We're competing with other nations now, and particularly with China and with Russia. For what? For influence, for resources, for allies, for partners, for access, for all of these things. So we may be willing to take risk in Africa, but sooner or later we have to come back to the fact that China is not. China is very active there. They're making many investments. It's part of the geopolitical calculus, whether we think so or not. They do. So we wanted to understand better what that looks like and what it means. For example, cobalt. Something like 50% of the world's cobalt is produced in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Cobalt is an essential mineral for the information age economy and military. Now, there are substitutes. Maybe it won't always be. Maybe we'll find other places to get it. But right now, that's one of the most important sources in the entire world. So who do you think is spending a lot of time there and making investments there and forming relationships there? Not us. I think it's our job as an independent organization to understand better what that means for the United States and for our long-term interests. So I think our strategy for great power competition and to protect our own interests has to be more than what's this year or next year or in the FYDP or, you know, we need to be thinking also long-term. And long-term, if this is really a global contest and it's a global competitive space, then everyone's in it. And we need to be thinking that way. So I understand it's a limited budget at the end of the day, even though it's a big one. but we also need to be able to think multidimensionally. So,
thank you.
Well, we started at the beginning of the conversation talking about climate change, at least a little bit, and kind of quickly went to the Arctic. And we can conclude with this, whether it's climate change or maybe there's another environmental security issue that you don't think people are talking about as much as they should, especially in the special operations community or national security in general, what would you say that might be? What should we be thinking about?
To me, it's all a constellation. I hope you'll forgive me for going way out to the horizon line, but if you start in the year 1800, there were 1 billion humans on Earth, and almost all of them lived in extreme poverty, almost everyone. But you come to now, there's 7 billion humans on Earth, and 10% of them live in extreme poverty. That's still too many. There are too many people who don't live as well as they should and who suffer a great deal. And, you know, we as a community of nations need to do better. However, this is an amazing moment in human history. I think it was actually the former President Obama who said, who wrote in an article in Wired that if you could choose any time to be alive in human history, you would choose now. This is the least miserable time to be human. Now, it's still miserable for a lot of people, but it's the least miserable time. But what got us here? Well, fossil fuels got us here. Oil, gas, and coal, and the Industrial Revolution brought us to this moment where I don't have to be afraid that my children are going to die of smallpox or polio. It's not going to happen, right? So we have this amazing moment in human history. However, everything that's gotten us here is laying in all the problems of the next 100 years. If we can't make a quick transition away from a fossil fuel-based economy, by the end of the century, it's going to go back to being miserable for humans. So that is the challenge of our time. And that is the environmental sort of security challenge that we need to consider, is that everything that made us great is now undermining us. So it's climate change and the fact that it has worldwide effects that range from unpredictable, volatile weather, which is going to mean an increasing humanitarian disaster relief profile, to higher heat in places that already have lots of problems with heat. It's going to mean more, you know, disease vectors are moving around. It's going to mean that you can't grow things where you used to grow things. There's going to be more water where you don't want it and less water where you do. We need to understand what the implications of that are for global stability and where it might have mission implications for the United States, where our interests and our prosperity are going to be at stake. We don't understand those things well enough yet. We could. There's a lot of science that could help us understand better what to expect. But there's a whole constellation of effects here. There's biodiversity loss. Extinctions in the natural world are at the highest they've been since, like, the dinosaurs were killed off.
My 8-year-old tells me that every week. She's right. Really disturbed by it. She hears that all the time. And she, as an 8-year-old kid,
the one thing you can
alarmed.
Tell her, if it helps,
yeah,
is
no,
you can
God,
say,
I need help,
we're an
Sharon,
immensely
yes.
adaptable species. Yeah. And the Earth has survived worse challenges, right? The Earth will be okay. The question is, will we be okay?
The thumbs help,
yeah. Right? We have a lot of capacity to adapt, but we have to try.
Right.
So I think we have to be honest about the fact that everything that's made it great, made the world great for humanity and allowed us to flourish to the point where it's an unbelievable amount of people now, and again, who are fewer in extreme poverty, fewer starving to death. Things are better, but to keep it better and to make sure that more people get better, we're going to have to change the way we live. And I don't think we're at that point of honesty yet. So all those environmental changes, we both need to be able to find another way, but also we need to be realistic about what the effects are going to be of biodiversity loss, of climate change, of switching to a different kind of energy. So, for example, if we succeed, we're not going to care as much about oil and the geopolitics of oil, but we might care a lot about the geopolitics of cobalt because it's really important for clean energy technologies. So we have to do, I think, as a national security community, start thinking more clearly about realistically what the world we live in and what we need to live in and what we're going to live in so that we can adapt. So I think that's part of our challenge, is to understand we're warfighters in the national security community, but to understand what it means for war and peace and how you get peace in this world, we haven't done enough yet to grapple with that. So I think we have a lot of work to do to understand better what the roots of conflict, what are we going to be struggling with in great power competition, and how do we make that not a shooting war? Those are the questions we should know the answer to, as much as how far along is the hypersonic missile. So,
sure.
I agree. Well, thank you, Sharon,
thank you very much.
Thank you for that.
What fun.
And the
what
challenge.
A great conversation.
Yeah,
I really appreciate it. You all ask difficult but really great questions. Yeah.
Well, we're glad we have you tackling this issue.
Yeah, thank you for the work you're doing.
Soft Spot is brought to you by the Global Soft Foundation, a 501c3 based in Tampa, Florida. If you're new to us, you can find out more about the foundation at gsoft.org. That's Gulf Sierra October Foxtrot.org.